Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 80. Ben Flanagan of AL.com.
Walton Goggins, congratulations on The Hateful Eight. I saw the Roadshow version yesterday and really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much, man. I'm so happy you got to see it in 70 millimeter.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. That's a pretty unique experience, and I just am curious about how your feelings on that presentation and being shot that way. I know Tarantino is obviously very passionate. Is that something you share?
I do. Yeah, I do. And, you know, there is no greater leader, you know, no greater motivator for this format than Quentin. You know, he has a way of contextualizing what this experience is and putting it into the history of cinema and what the movies that came before The Hateful Eight were and how they were photographed and what that means, like seeing images that haven't been seen in 50 years. You know, actors haven't been in front of these lenses in a very long time. And Quentin is an analog guy in a digital world who celebrates film. And to be, you know, invited on this train with him and with these other actors and the crew, for that matter, is a real dream come true.
Well, I can imagine that the first phone call you get to work on a Quentin Tarantino movie is pretty exciting, but you got a second call to come work again with a much larger role. What did that mean to you that an artist of his caliber wanted to explore a deeper collaboration with this kind of material in a character as rich as Chris Mannix?
What a great question. You know, you hope, I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and you hope that you can, over the course of your career, build a body of work that someone or not that there is anyone else like Quentin, but that someone like Quentin would notice what you've been doing and give you, you know, that opportunity. And for me, that opportunity doesn't lead to something else. This is the opportunity. You know what I mean? I live my life in the present and to get this invitation from him with his stable of actors, including his muse, Samuel L. Jackson, and to be this role in this film is, you know, man, it's to say that it's over the moon or to say that I'm pinching myself or to use any other colloquialism or there aren't enough positive adjectives in the English language to adequately express, you know, my feelings about this experience. You know, it's been religious for me in a number of ways. You know, it's like going to church and getting baptized, really. You know, it's really something that I will never, ever, ever forget.
Well, he often refers to his own work, particularly his writing, as poetry, and you certainly have a knack for the rhythm of his language. And I mean, you've got what I think is one of his best lines in Django Unchained, and you obviously power through Chris Mannix's words in Hateful Eight. You've even referred to it as loquacious poetry before, but what do you think he means when he describes it that way?
Well, no one writes the way that Quentin does. You know, the only other person that I have ever read who Quentin is a disciple of is Elmore Leonard. And there's this elegant accessibility to his words, and they don't just fit in your mouth. They're just not coming out as words. People don't just hear them as words. They're visual. Like just for instance, a speech that Sam Jackson, a monologue that Sam Jackson has in this movie. I think you know which one I'm talking about. If you were to close your eyes and the visual imagery that Quentin pairs with his words were not available to you. If you were to just close your eyes during Sam's speech, then you would see exactly what is being spoken. He has this way with his, like even Royale with cheese, or even in any speech that that the wolf makes, or that, you know, whatever that is, whatever that insert character here, you can see it. You see what's happening as much as you hear what's happening. And they're so specific, and they're so uniquely Tarantino that, and I don't know another writer working today in movies that has this quality. But if you were to close your eyes and you were given 2 minutes of a conversation written by Quentin Tarantino, and you didn't know who the author was, you would know that it's Tarantino dialogue. It's like listening to Bob Dylan, man. If you just close your eyes, you know those lyrics are Bob. If you read them, right, and you don't hear Bob's voice. The same with Quentin. If you just hear actors speaking words, you would know within 2 minutes that it's a Quentin Tarantino scene. And that's very unique and very powerful. I don't know how he does it, man. You know, I have no idea. I just know that I'm grateful that I get to say it.
Well, I know that you were raised in Georgia, but I'm curious, what is your current relationship with your birthplace, Birmingham, Alabama?
Well, I only lived there a year, the first year of my life, so it wasn't, you know, my choice to leave. Obviously, a year old doesn't dictate his surroundings, but I have a great affinity for Alabama and culturally. My aunt, who is an actress in the theater and did regional equity theater all over the country, but spent a lot of time working in Birmingham, and I went, you know, back and forth and sat in those dinner theaters and theaters in Birmingham, and that really formed my early experience and early exposure to storytelling. So in some ways, I it wasn't the fact that I was born in Birmingham that changed my life. It was the fact that I saw my aunt and uncle doing theater in Birmingham that changed my life. So, I wouldn't be what I was doing today without their good fortune in Birmingham and then subsequently being able to see it.
Well, what advantage do you think that your heritage...
I love the music, Patterson Hood. I love Muscle Shoals. Come on, I love the soul food. I love it all, man.
Well, what advantage do you think that heritage and your cultural background gives you, whether you're auditioning or being sought after for a role that happens to have a Southern connection?
Well, it's uniquely yours, isn't it? You know, I spent my early years, in Los Angeles, trying to get away from my upbringing and trying to be. And trying to talk differently, trying to expand my horizons, only to come back to them in a way that I never could have if I had just stayed in the South. And I think that's what happens when you get away from the nascent kind of part of your being. You come back to it and you see it, you know, you see it a different way. There's a quote by, who is it? Just give me a second here. I'll give you this time. It's by, T.S. Eliot. It's a quote by T.S. Eliot that says, a life is an exploration, and the end of that exploring will be to arrive from the place that we started and know that place for the first time. And that's really kind of been my experience and my association to the South, and I've been given soapboxes or forums in which to contextualize for other people the Southern experience and to broaden their definition of the South, and it's something that is very important to me, and it's something that I take very seriously, and I feel like I've been a part of the evolving conversation about the South over the last 10 years, certainly through my run on Justified.
Certainly, and Boyd Crowder was a white supremacist, and Billy Crash was a slave driver, and now Chris Mannix was obviously a young man raised to hate black people in the Confederate South. These are only three of your many roles, obviously, but I'm curious about how a Southern-born actor approaches roles like these, perhaps a little differently than others with less familiarity with the history of racial tension in the South. How do you initially go about finding a way into understanding and connecting with these characters that people might otherwise find pretty deplorable?
Well, I think for Boyd Crowder, we had a conversation early on because I said no to playing Boyd Crowder three times before I really had a soul-to-soul conversation with Tim Oliphant, whom I'm a very big fan of, and Graham Yost, our showrunner. And I said, listen, this is the pilot. This is what it says. I will say these things only one way. I will say these things if you let Boyd Crowder off the hook by saying, I don't believe that you necessarily believe everything that you're saying, Boyd. And that's where I was in my life at that time. And that's what I believed to be the truth about Boyd Crowder. I feel like he's more of a Svengali than a racist. And once, you know, we did the pilot, I mean, he's a self-taught man. He's a person who it was more about economics for him and the lack of opportunity based on economics, that informed his experience. It wasn't about a hatred towards African-Americans. And he was, again, just regurgitating these inflammatory statements to build an audience. But then we did 78 episodes, so that's episode one. Episode two, he's a born-again Christian with African-Americans in his church. So my parameters for continuing on in that journey for Boyd Crowder was that he be a figure in the South that I know. People that I know that expand upon that definition of a racist, but that he be the smartest man in the room, and someone that is self-taught, someone that is a has an appreciation for poetry and for language and for literature, and you know, some of the most interesting artists that I've ever met in my life, come black or white, come from the South, and race is not a part of that. And I wanted to have that experience with Boyd Crowder to expand the definition of what it means to come from the South, and I feel like I was able to do that, and that's something that I'm very proud of. With Django, what Quentin wrote, what ultimately didn't make it into the movie, but what he wrote was, you know, a white man who had risen through the only corporation in town, which was the slave plantation structure. He was a poor white man who had risen to the top through the horrible subjugation of a race of people, and that is a worldview that needed to be articulated and expressed in a way to highlight the horrific treatment of African Americans in this country. And if I can do that, and I can be in the service of telling the black experience, you can bet your ass I'm going to do that, because that's that is a part of what it is to be from the South, and to look any other way would be denying, you know, where this came from, where this horrible treatment of another group of people came from. And so that was that experience. And Chris Mannix, then for me, and what Quentin has written in this, is the next evolutionary step of race relations in this country. You know, Chris Mannix starts off as in an arrested state of development, regurgitating a worldview that is dictated by the legacy of his father and his surroundings. He's never had a conversation with an African American, and it is a journey from that darkness, from that small-minded point of view, to one of liberation from ignorance, and one, you know, that says no, I'm going from a boy to a man, a person able to think for myself, and it's a beautiful transition, that arc, if you will, that Quentin has written for Chris Mannix, and the fact that I got to go through that with one of my icons, Samuel L. Jackson, who is Quentin's muse, is, I can't believe it, man. And I'm sitting here talking to you. Hotel in Nashville. Look at that. In Nashville.
Well, Walton Goggins, thank you so much. Congratulations on this movie. I've been a huge fan of yours ever since The Apostle, which is a movie that's very special to me personally. My wife is a huge fan of Boyd, and it's just been an honor to talk to you, and I wish you the best of luck.
Hey, I really, really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for the articulate questions, mate.
Hey, well, have a great day.
Have a great day. Okay.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.